thank you all for coming. This is really, this is fantastic to put this together so quickly. And thank you to Sherry for organizing and the rest of Skirball. And thank you to Rivers for giving us some great music.
Yeah. I was going to say that if a 23-year-old version of myself knew that I was ever going to follow Rivers Cuomo on a stage, I would not have envisioned to talk about meditation as the punchline.
Let's talk about how we met, because we actually, as Sherry said, there's no relation, although I recently did a podcast with Russell Brand, who clearly thought I was you. We got about 20 minutes into the podcast, and I realized I was doing a very bad Dan Harris impersonation. So we met first somewhere at an atheist conference, but then you moderated a debate I did with Deepak Chopra. Michael Shermer was on my team, and then Gene Houston was on Deepak's team, and only one of us wore rhinestone glasses. It was not Gene Houston. But backstage, I don't know if you were already into meditation at that point, but you had never sat a retreat. I remember my wife and I, Annika and I, browbeat you that you had to sit a retreat, and you have just gone hook, line, and sinker.
Oh, yeah.
And now you meditate 2 hours a day.
You know what's coming next?
Shame.
What? Rhinestone glasses.
Yes, right. That's right. Give it a few years.
I got to earn those.
But you have just gone. You went immediately from essentially zero to being super diligent, and now it's a major part of your public platform. I mean, this is your second book, and if you haven't read either of these books, you probably haven't read the newest one because it just came out. But these are the books I recommend you read as a first book on meditation if you are at all of a skeptical bent, because you came into this really perfectly calibrated for the skeptical mind, and if you can find some there, it's contagious. So, well done on the books.
Re-meeting you, because I think the first time we met was, as you said, the American Atheist Convention, which I was covering as a journalist, and you were there as a card-carrying atheist. Yeah. And you got up at that event and actually gave a speech that you later described as the first time that you began with a standing ovation and ended with booze, because you said to the atheist, first of all, I don't think we should be using the word atheist, and then you went on to say that there are forms of spirituality that they had closed their mind to. I didn't hear the speech. I just met you outside in front of like all of these t-shirts that said like, Jesus, save us from your followers. And
I was not wearing one of those t-shirts.
That was RTs are not endorsements. I met you and we hit it off, but it was a short encounter. And then I saw you backstage at this debate and we really started talking, and I had just gotten into meditation. And the fact that you were into it, which I did not know, because I hadn't heard the speech, was hugely validating, because you struck me as like the prototypical skeptic.
Right.
And so that really, when you told me you should go on a retreat, and Annika, who's also quite skeptical, said, hey, you should go on a retreat, I took it seriously. Mm. Plus, I was writing a book, and I need some shit to write about, so.
Although, ironically, because I got into meditation so much earlier, I mean, I think I was 19 when I started, and I had no real scientific training to speak of at that point, and I certainly had no persona as an atheist. And I was an atheist, but I didn't think of myself as an atheist. I didn't go into it with your level of skepticism. I mean, all the things that you're allergic to, that you talk about, the patchouli oil and the bad music, none of that was an impediment to me. So what's amazing...
You were cool with didgeridoo music and
Cat Stevens. I went to India and I walked around in pajamas for a long time. I mean, it was... I had you were trying to for one of those pieces you did. You were trying to pry photos of me with long hair out of my reluctant fingers.
You were willing to give it to me, but Annika intervened.
That's right. And the only reason why there's not hippie photos of me out on the net is because my wife wisely saved me at the 11th hour. So I was a teenager and I got into it. One of the things that's so useful about your books is that you prove that there is a doorway into this concern and, the, and this practice that is narrow enough and brightly lit enough so as to not admit any bullshit. And that's, and you don't have to take on any cultural trappings and be fascinated with Eastern religion or anything to find this useful.
I think it's just an incredibly important thing to know. I often say that meditation has been the victim of the worst marketing campaign for anything ever. Mm. And because it's been presented to us in this very flowery way, and actually there are many levels to the bad marketing, but just to address the level on which you're speaking is that it just comes with all this cultural baggage that for people like me is just deeply off-putting. And as I've written about the fact that my parents were hippies and they made me go to a yoga class when I was little and the teacher didn't like my tough skin pants and made me do sun salutations in my tidy whiteies, and that created a lifelong hostility to anything like that. And so I really hated that stuff. And so meditation just never even came on my radar screen until I started seeing the science. Hmm. And that there is, and we have to be careful when we talk about the science because it's still in its early stages and some of the science is frankly just not of a high quality, but I think what we can safely say is that it strongly suggests that meditation can confer a long list of tantalizing health benefits. And that to me was really what started to change my mind and meeting people like you.
Well, that's interesting because it seems to me that there are two doorways into this, at least two, and they're not the same. And so the first that you've just described is the usefulness of the practice. And so and that extends now, as we know, to at least some medical claims that seem fairly well-founded. But there's another door, which is the door I took, which is really still what I emphasize in my thinking about this, which is just it's the door of what is true about the mind from the first person side. So what is it actually like to be you if you pay attention? And what you find if you're new to this practice and even for the longest time is that it's very hard to pay attention. Just getting to the place where you can notice anything is quite a feat and takes training. But you can go through that door and not necessarily care that much about the benefits. I often think that I would still be interested in meditation even if it were not good for you. You know, even if it were a little bad for you. I mean, there are people who get into sports which are clearly not all that healthy, but they still love the sport. And this is a kind of intellectual sport in a way, which I think you can become fascinated by even if you're not sold that it reliably reduces stress or anything else that it seems to do.
I agree. I mean, my intuition as a storyteller, but also as a practitioner, and now as what I sort of like semi-facetiously use the word evangelist for the practice, is that it's, I think, more widely attractive to talk about the benefits. The bigger door. But I think many people quickly get to what you're talking about, which is getting an experience of what our minds and therefore our lives are actually about. Hmm. And that becomes for many of us practitioners, becomes extremely interesting. Hmm. I also think, as it pertains to the science, that, look, I think as an endeavor, it's a good field of interest, but it's, for me as an evangelist, the science is useful as a way to get people interested who might not otherwise be interested, but it doesn't have much of a bearing on your actual practice. Like, as I like to say, that you might start meditating because you see the brain scans, but you don't keep meditating because you think your prefrontal cortex would look different in an fMRI right now. You keep meditating because you're less of an asshole to yourself and others, and that is the metric that matters.
Yeah, yeah. It occurs to me now, actually,
I think both doors lead you to that, being less of an asshole.
Right. Yeah, although you can still be an asshole, I find, rather regularly.
Less of an asshole.
One can be an asshole.
Our wives are both here, so if we want to flesh out this part of the discussion, get a mic to them.
It occurs to me we might want to just sit for 2 or 3 minutes just so that everyone knows what we're talking about. I assume many people in this room have at least had some experience with meditation, but if not, let's just do it for 2 minutes so we are on the same page. So you might close your eyes. You don't have to close your eyes, but many people like to do it that way. And sit a little more erect, just comfortably. And bring your attention to the sounds in the room. Just let each sound, whether it's my voice or anything else, reveal this space of awareness that is knowing. And you also might feel your body resting in space. The feeling of gravity, of pressure on the chair, on the armrests. So keep your attention wide open. And the moment you notice you're thinking, just come back to hearing sounds and feeling the weight of your body. And then you might begin to pay attention to the breath, whether you feel it at the tip of the nose or in the rising and falling of your chest or abdomen. See if you can follow the next inhalation from the moment it appears. And so too with the exhalation. And again, the moment you notice you're thinking, just come back to sensation, whether it's the breath, or the feeling of just sitting, or the sounds. And now you can open your eyes and notice this field of color and light and shadow that you see. This is actually the same place where you're hearing sounds and feeling sensations. This is also the open space of consciousness. There's really no place else for anything to appear but in consciousness. This is also the place you see with your open eyes is the same place where you're thinking too, because you can broadcast a thought into this field of color and light. So just to test this, I want you all to picture the Eiffel Tower in front of you as a statue. Make it about 2 feet high. Now, depending on how good you are at visualizing things, it may be a very evanescent image, may be barely an image, but it is something. It's not the same as picturing a bicycle. So that this is the place you see with your open eyes is also your mind. It's also consciousness. So meditation, and now I'm officially talking and not just guiding a meditation. Meditation is just the art of paying more careful attention to everything that's already happening, sights and sounds and sensations and changes in mood, and ultimately even thoughts can arise as objects of meditation and not distract you. But for the longest time when you're training in this, you're either lost in thought or you're aware of your senses, essentially. And thought is, at least presents itself as a kind of antithesis to meditation because we are so distractible by it. But ultimately, it's not about getting rid of thought or thinking less. It's actually just noticing everything that's arising as it arises, including thought. What has your experience? So now Dan's done many retreats where you go into silence for a week or 10 days at a time and spend 12 to 18 hours a day, depending on how much you're sleeping, doing just what we were doing for the last few minutes. You can do it while walking, you can do it while sitting, and you alternate hour by hour. So what was that first retreat like that Anika and I goaded you into doing?
It sucked. It was the first 4 days were some of the hardest days of my whole life. Mm-hmm. Where you're just surrounded by all these weirdos and...
You're welcome.
Yeah. Oh, I had things I wanted to say to you. And the hardest part is not... People often latch onto the silence part of it. Hmm. There was nobody there I wanted to chat with. And I actually, despite the fact that I'm a professional talker... Actually, not a huge problem for me to be quiet. So that wasn't the issue, nor was it really the other people there who actually weren't that weird. I'm just joking. Although my mind was judging them all the time. It was sitting and meditating or walking and meditating all day long was incredibly hard. You just really are thrown up against your own insanity. And... Mm. I was ready to quit and went and sat with this teacher. Actually, the teacher I hated the most was the only one available. And you're allowed to talk to the teacher. So I was telling her this about how horrible it was. And she just said, "You're trying too hard." And so I kind of the next meditation session, instead of sitting in the meditation hall with everybody else, I went and sat on the balcony outside of on the hallway where I was staying. There was a balcony at the end of the hallway in this one building that I was staying in, and had this kind of experience of effortless awareness of whatever was happening. So I was noticing the rustle of the leaves, the wind, the pain in my knee, the fact that I was distracted, and then starting again, and it was all just coming really fast and easy, and I wasn't trying as hard. And I have described it as, it was like those first 4 days on retreat where I was like I was being dragged by a motorboat by my head underwater, and it was horrible, as that would probably be. And then in that sit outside, it was like I got up on water skis. Hmm. And I could see what the point of this whole thing was, which is when the thinking, the volume of your inner conversation goes down significantly, there's an enormous amount of serotonin that accompanies that. And life is much more vivid. Mm. And you understand how these unseen conversations you are having with yourself drive you nuts. Yeah. You're judging, you're wanting, and that then leads you to, you know, eat when you're not hungry, or as I sometimes do, say the thing that ruins the next 48 hours of your marriage. Mm. And this is just a very powerful insight, and really is actually available to anybody who sits and meditates even for 2 minutes, that you're fucking crazy. And when you don't see the craziness, when you're unaware of the aforementioned nonstop conversation, it owns you. And so yeah. That moment where my inner conversation, that chatter had come the volume came way down, that was really interesting and led to about 36 hours of some of the purest happiness I've ever experienced. And then it went away, as all things do. But I came away from that retreat with, and this is a loaded phrase, word rather, in your presence, Sam, but I came away from that retreat with a lot of faith in the practice, confidence that this is not like, you know, the mental version of hacky sack, that, you know, just something that hippies do to pass the time, that this is real.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that's a fine use of faith. I'm not allergic to the word. I mean, it's confidence that you are not uniquely cursed,
yeah.
And that this sort of inner landscape that has been well mapped by other people and described, if you perform this experiment on yourself, you will have similar results. Mm-hmm. It does. I mean, it seems to take so before you went on retreat, you had been meditating. Did you retrospectively feel that you really had never been meditating before you did the retreat, or did you? Because I had that experience where once I did a 10-day retreat, I realized that for the previous year, I had just been sitting cross-legged and thinking with my eyes closed. And I think I had never I had never broken through to anything other than, you know, boy, it feels good to sit here with beads on and think.
I want those pictures. Look, I actually think that's a, again, I'm gonna revert back to.
I realize this is counter-programming to the message that
yes,
that 1 minute a day is adequate. Yes.
So I'm gonna get back on the program here, yeah. Because I actually think that there are, like any skill, any field of endeavor, there are levels to it,
yeah.
And if you sit and try to meditate and notice that you've become distracted and start again and again and again, that is meditation. It's meditation, and you are deriving a lot of benefit from that, because every time you see how crazy you are, the craziness has less power over you. And that can happen for anybody at any time, anywhere. And so I will not back away from that. I will, however, concede that for sure, that you, once you put yourself in a container where everything about it is designed to support your meditation practice, you have no other responsibility. You're being fed, housed, instructed, that you can reach levels that are, for me at least, unavailable on the subway.
So I've come full circle on this, where I feel like the thing that is most important to glimpse in the practice that many people only tend to find on you know, after intensive retreat is the thing that you can see on the subway. I mean, there actually is no, the connection to retreat disappears ultimately, and it need only last a moment to be extremely valuable. So let's talk about the crazy side of it for a second.
I want just to dig into that for a second, yeah. Because there are the thing about meditation, one of the many things about meditation is so interesting to me, is that you can emphasize different aspects. So I tend to emphasize the aspect of seeing how crazy you are. Because I hear from people all the time who say, I can't meditate because my mind's too busy. And so I've made it my business to tell those people, no, you are meditating. The fact that you're noticing that your mind is busy is a success. What you're calling a failure is success.
Yeah.
And here's why it's a success, because every time you see how distracted you are, you notice something about your mind, which is that you're crazy. And then then when anger or distraction or whatever ambushes you later in the day, you have better odds of not being owned by it. You emphasize a different aspect to which I think is this is the thing you were about to say, that you can see on the subway. which I agree with you, but it's harder for people to grasp, right? Because you you write about this brilliantly in Waking Up, which I've read like maybe four times. But I think it's harder for people to understand what it is that you are emphasizing. So maybe make a run at that. I know you're supposed to be asking me the questions, but
no. Well, I realize I'm outgunned here. I'm sitting next to a professional journalist, and this was bound to happen. How many minutes did I last interviewing? Well, let's talk about the crazy for a second, because crazy sounds like an exaggeration, but what you get when you have any significant experience in meditation is a very different picture of what a healthy mind must be like. And we have the status quo is so close to psychotic that the difference for me is just the fact that most of us, most of the time, have the good sense to keep our mouths shut and not vocalize the things we're thinking. But just imagine if everyone could hear what you're thinking all the time, or if you helplessly said the words that you're actually thinking with the voice of your mind all day long, you would be indistinguishable from someone who was actually crazy. And it's just, you'll tell yourself the same story again and again and again. You have no capacity for boredom, apparently, inside your head. But if you were forced to exteriorize that, you would immediately be confronted with the evidence that you were stark, raving mad. And so that's what you get from Buddhism as a tradition, but really even from any kind of secular immersion in this practice is a different sense of what a healthy mind would be like. And it's not to be, it can't entail spending virtually every moment of your waking life identified with thought and unaware that you're essentially living in a kind of waking dreamscape where you're just, if it's a depressing thought, you're depressed. If it's a happy thought, you're happy. If it's a fearful thought, you're afraid. And you're just being played and just subsumed in each moment by these images and these sentences that in many cases are totally superfluous. I mean, this is an experience that I often have. I walk out on stage like this and I notice, you know, I tend to drink a lot of water at events like this. I notice there's water and there'll be a voice in my head. I'm not schizophrenic, so it's actually my voice. It's not somebody else's voice. But, I'll think, oh, good, there's water there. But who am I telling, right? I can see the water, right? You know, there's no one else that needs to be informed about this. So most of our, it's not to say that we don't need thoughts for anything, but so much of our conversation with ourselves is deeply superfluous.
I agree, and from personal experience, you know, there's a great writer. I don't know if you think he's great, but I think he's great. Stephen Batchelor, who writes books about he writes books about Buddhism from the perspective of an atheist, although it's a little bit redundant because there's no God in Buddhism anyway. But he has said, and I'm probably not going to quote this exactly, but that if you look long enough into your own mind, you'll see a murderer and a rapist. You will see the capacity we all have for all sorts of things, beautiful things, ugly things. And that's okay, actually. That is part of the process. The seeing of the craziness, how hilarious it is, how shameful it is, how scary it is. This is what we're doing. This is the business. This is at least the aspect that I, at first at least, emphasize because I think it is so useful to see this stuff so that it doesn't own you.
Yeah, and it's good to break the habit, which you emphasize in probably both books, but having just read your current one, you do it a lot there, which is this judgment that comes naturally to someone who's trying to learn to meditate, which is the moment you notice you're lost in thought, you've been distracted for 5 minutes or whatever while you thought you were meditating, you've been thinking about lunch or replaying some conversation in your head. And the moment you notice that, it's very common to have an additional moment of judgment about that. Mm-hmm. Like, fuck, I was supposed to be meditating. I'm like, well, when am I going to learn to do this? And yet you skillfully reframe that as that's a moment of success. Win. I mean, that's when it's actually working.
Hashtag winning, as Charlie Sheen says. Yeah. No, I really do. I mean, that is an incredibly important thing to know. And I think it is what allows many people to do this, because so many of us believe the story we're telling ourselves about how we could never meditate because you don't understand my mind. I hear this all the time. My mind is so busy that I could never do this. I call it the fallacy of uniqueness. Mm. Because we think that we have this kind of lunacy that only we have. But that this is the human condition. We evolved on the savannas, you know, for threat detection and for finding sources of pleasure and for a racing mind. And this is the, if we weren't all like this, we wouldn't need meditation.
Now currently, so this was like 10 years ago. When did we first meet?
We met, and I believe the Jesus t-shirt thing was in like 2006.
Right.
And
right.
I think the
thing, so when did you set your first retreat?
I did in 2010, I think. Yeah, 2010. So I think I met you in 2009.
Right. So now this is it's actually part of your job now. I mean, now you have you've designed your life so that you have to meditate. I mean, this is a
it's
great
family business.
It's a great gig, yeah.
Just want to put a pin in the fact that you evaded my question
about
the aspect.
Okay.
So you can get to it at your own pace.
No, I can be dragged back to that. So the question is, what is the
aspect that you emphasize a different aspect here, which is the thing that you were saying before can be seen on the subway, which I agree with, but it's a different thing or no thing at all.
So this is really the truth door versus the useful door, or the utility door. There was no guarantee that seeing the character of your mind more clearly, which is to say more accurately, more truthfully, would be useful. We could live in a universe where it would destabilize you in some way, right? It could be, and it may in fact be bad for some people, and I think there's certainly people who shouldn't do intensive retreats. I think that's, you know, it can exacerbate certain psychological conditions. I think there's a
trauma.
Yeah, there's a.
I didn't mean that as a joke.
Yeah,
I meant like
no,
if you have trauma,
true,
that it is something you should talk to a professional beforehand.
So, and there is a very small literature on people who feel like they have been harmed by doing intensive practice because they just were thrown in the deep end of the pool and didn't swim well. But those are certainly minority cases. But if you get a group of 200 people together, there's very likely going to be one person for whom it was a bad idea to do an intensive retreat. I guess it's conceivable that's true of a daily practice, but I think it's very unlikely that sitting in the middle of your life for 20 minutes and paying attention, as we just did, would be bad for anyone. But if the disclaimer is valid. If you find that it seems like it's not doing anything good for you, then or doing something bad for you, then you should consult a psychotherapist who knows about these things, and many now do. I mean, mindfulness has invaded the psychotherapeutic community, and it's understood by many, many of them. But it just is a fact that seeing certain features of consciousness more clearly seems to be very helpful psychologically in many ways. It doesn't help everything. I mean, you can still, at whatever level of stability you are in the practice, you're still going to spend most of your time lost in thought, and then you are hostage to whatever the character of your thoughts are. So if you're an asshole when you're thinking, well, then you're probably still an asshole most of the time. But it's possible to punctuate that with a very clear seeing of some surprising facts about consciousness. And one is that consciousness itself, just the sheer fact of knowing anything, you know, whether it's a visual perception or an internal appearance like a thought, that condition of knowing in and of itself doesn't feel like a self. It doesn't feel like I. It doesn't feel like the subject that most people think is riding around in their heads having the thoughts and the experiences and appropriating everything from this position of being a subject inside the head. And it's possible to recognize that, and that is freeing in a fairly radical way. I mean, all of the highfalutin language you get from the contemplative traditions, for the most part, is anchored to that kind of insight, that the ego is an illusion, or that the self is an illusion, or that duality, the subject-object perception, is an illusion. And it can be a very ordinary realization. It doesn't have to come with all the pyrotechnics of a kind of psychedelic experience. I mean, you don't have to feel like you're on acid in order to have that insight. But what that insight does is it does radically interrupt this identification with thought and with all of the things that follow from being identified with thought, which are all the mediocre emotions that play us so much of the time.
Yeah, I mean, one way to get this is, you know, what Sam was saying before, when he was guiding us in meditation, he first had us just listen to the sounds in the room. You could do this at home later if you want. You listen to the sounds, you can do it now, and just try to find who or what is hearing them. You look, you won't find anything. There isn't some little nugget of you there that you can find. And that is something you can explore ad infinitum. And does, I think, slowly, at least in my experience, slowly lead to a compounded realization that the you that you think is so solid and that you're spending so much time trying to defend or advance the interests of actually doesn't have as much, if any, substance as you've long assumed. Did that appropriately amplify your point?
Yeah. And although it also revealed these two different orientations that...
I tried to make it too useful, is your point.
Yeah, no, but this issue of fixating on retreat as being the necessary circumstance of meditation, there are two different paths to that insight you just described. So to take hearing as the basis of this, it's possible to pay such close attention to the experience of hearing, so every little impingement on your eardrum, just to catch it the moment it occurs and to notice it's passing away the moment it disappears, you pay such laser-like attention to that experience that for brief moments, the sense that there's a hearer and a thing heard, that collapses and there's just pure hearing. So there is no sense of self in the midst of that noticing. But that seems to require this massive buildup of energy that people get, for the most part, only on retreat, where you get work up to that by just being continuous in your mindfulness. It's also possible to sort of take it from the other side, which you were sort of suggesting, which is that if you look for the one who's hearing, you can notice, without especially fixating so closely on what is being heard, you can notice that there is actually no subject there. There is just this sort of wide open space where sounds are appearing. And that's the kind of experience that equalizes retreat and life, because it's clear that the moment preceding was not a moment of you having some heroic level of concentration that you don't normally have or can't normally aspire to. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing, that's why you said you can do it on the subway. You can look around in the subway and just ask yourself the question, who's seeing all of this? Where's the me? And you won't find it. And there's something very healthy about the looking and not finding that in my experience, can you start to chip away at the sense of inner solidity, which is really the source of most, if not all, of our suffering, this that we're constantly trying to advance or defend the interests of this me. This is not to say that you have this realization or you try to systematize this realization in your life and then you don't have to put your pants on in the morning. That's not the goal here. The goal is that you start to see, in my view, that you start to see yourself for what it is, which is a mystery.
Yeah, one mystery I'm now confronted by is there's no clock up here.
What time is it?
I don't know
it's
how long.
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock, okay. I think we want a good long while for Q&A, so it might be the moment to transition to that. I don't know what the mechanism
there's
is
Mike's,
by which we're going to...
Mike's right there on both sides of the stage. It's a brave young gentleman.
How are you? I'm Nico. Thanks for coming and chatting about meditation. I guess my question is... when you've gone on these long retreats, and I guess particularly you, Sam, who's been away for 10 years going on these retreats on and off, at what point did you decide, you know, it's time to come back, given that, you know, meditation and mindfulness is such a critical part to mental health? And if you were in those moments of mindfulness being super, you know, happy mentally, when did you say, hey, you know, it's actually time to end this and come back?
Well, I was writing, and originally I thought I was going to be writing. I'm sorry, I would turn toward you, but then I'm not aligned with my microphone anymore, so I'll talk to you as though you're here. Better to hear me than see me looking at you speaking wordlessly. So I was writing. I thought I was going to write fiction, and if you're writing fiction, nobody cares that you dropped out of school and didn't make much of your academic career. But the moment you transition to nonfiction, all of a sudden it becomes highly relevant, you know, how you know anything. So I decided I couldn't keep just sitting retreats and being entirely self-taught to write what I wanted to write. And it was very useful to go back to school to do it, because I had at that point all of the liabilities of being self-taught in every area that was relevant to me at that point, apart from meditation. And, you know, now I just have some of the liabilities of being self-taught.
First of all, thank you guys very much for doing what you're doing. I think, like, what you're doing in the public sphere and your individual ways is immensely helpful, and for people like me and probably lots of people here. My question having to do with meditation is, how often do you plateau in your practice? And how do you kind of deal with that, if at all?
You want to take that?
Sure. With the caveat that I'm not a meditation teacher. I'm just a guy who writes about meditation sometimes. And that Sam knows a lot more about this than I do. With that caveat, I think plateauing, or the perception of plateauing, is quite common. And probably not that useful to get too hung up on. Our mutual friend and my meditation teacher, I was introduced to by Sam, is a guy named Joseph Goldstein, who's been on Sam's podcast at least twice, which I recommend to everybody because those are great interviews. Joseph Goldstein often talks about this habit we have of playing what he calls the practice assessment tapes, where we're just obsessing about the state of our practice right now, and have we plateaued, or has our concentration level actually maybe diminished? Is this whole thing a waste of time? Am I a helpless case? Blah, blah, blah. This is just, to put it in Buddhist terms, a classical hindrance called doubt. Not doubt in the positive sense. Doubt in my line of work as a journalist is quite positive, but this is doubt in the pejorative, which is this quagmire, this quicksand of useless self-questioning. And so I would just put that flag out there for you to be aware that a certain amount of practice assessment is healthy, and it might be worth talking to a teacher. But in my experience, this can turn into ruminative spirals that are entirely unconstructive. And to know that the way a practice goes over time is, you know, sometimes based on whatever factors, exogenous factors in your life, your ability to concentrate isn't that good, or maybe actually you feel like you're not able to apply the lessons of meditation off the cushion in the rest of your life. There are many factors that can go into that, but in my experience over time, it's a sort of wavy line, but it does kind of go in the right direction.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harrison Harris, for sharing this with us. Dan, I wake up to you on you're my weekend home. I've read all of Proust, for those who might have read it, and I think I'm one of those people that got it. And I studied with Lee Strasberg, which really worked on our sensual memory, et cetera. And I read your book, your first book, Dan, which really opened a door to me of which I thought I could walk through. And I'm going to be very honest, I can fall into mindfulness within seconds and driving anything, my feet, I mean, everything. And it brings me to a place of my childhood. I realize that's how I used to be all the time. And it brings a lot of joy and I'm there and everything else is quiet. My question is, why is the choice not to go there so difficult? Because it's always there at my fingertips to be able to be in that place so easily. And why do we let ourselves be so diverted when we know that there's something that really does work?
Thank you.
Well, it is strange to, I mean, this is not just with something like meditation. I mean, even if it's, regardless of how accessible or inaccessible the pleasantness of meditation may be, we often paradoxically, I think, experience using our attention in ways that we regret, right? We do things we know we will regret, and we know they're not even that fulfilling while we're doing them, and yet we still do them. So this is a philosophical problem. This is a psychological problem. It's a bit of a paradox. And conversely, we don't do the thing we know will be satisfying and that we will not regret doing. And wisdom is in large measure just aligning your uses of attention in ways that you won't regret. So meditation is certainly one of the better tools to just notice the consequences of various uses of attention and, you know, ways of acting in the world, and to sort of keep a clear enough sense of those consequences so that you can get your priorities straight and paying close attention to the character of your experience in this way, as, you know, mindfulness is, at the end of the day, one of the things you won't regret doing.
But I would just say to give yourself a break, because I was talking about evolution before, and it's worth bringing that up again. We are not wired for this calm, non-judgmental awareness that is actually our birthright. You know, we have this innate capacity of mindfulness, but evolution really bequeathed us a mind that is really good at hypervigilance. And so to be cultivating this skill is to hack evolution in some ways, and that is available to you and to all of us is great, but that you often, for reasons that you don't fully understand, find yourself doing mindless things, I don't think is something that you need to berate yourself for. I think it's just the way we're wired, and berating yourself for it is just another story.
I didn't actually expect an answer that was going to make such a huge difference, but it did. Thank you.
Thanks for having such low expectations.
Hi, guys. First, I want to thank you for getting me to meditate. Sam, you sparked my interest many years ago. And Dan, your app finally got me to establish a practice and eventually go on a retreat. I know you guys are big fans of IMS and Spirit Rock as your recommendations, but for someone like myself, I found those prohibitively expensive, so I turned to the Goenka Vipassana, those 10-day retreets, because they're free and you can donate, which I do to your podcast. It's just like that in that regard. So I was wondering if you had any opinions on the Goenka retreat as it contrasts to the other retreats. I know there's walking meditation and you only do 45 minutes max at IMS. I looked at the schedules a little bit. I was wondering just if you had any opinions on their methodology and perhaps any alternative recommendations that something might be a more affordable.
Yeah, well, I should say that Rivers, who was just here, is a longtime Goenka student, and so it's that style of meditation is clearly better for one's musical ability than how we've been practicing. So yeah, it's a totally valid alternative. To the difference ultimately is probably non-existent, but in the beginning of the practice, it's a different technique of how you pay attention systematically to sensations. They actually use the breath as well, but they do this technique of body scanning where you systematically move through the body and notice sensation everywhere. But it is the same kind of attention. It's just mindfulness of the body as a foundation. So it's totally valid, and people have the same kinds of insights doing that. I don't actually know other good retreat centers to recommend. I don't know, you're more current in searching out what's actually there.
Well, what I would say about IMS and Spirit Rock, the two retreat centers that you referenced, one is called the Insight Meditation Society. It's based in central Massachusetts. It's where Joseph Goldstein lives. Spirit Rock is up north of Marin, I think. Mm-hmm. They're kind of sister organizations that I believe they have scholarships. So
they do, yeah.
So that I think is worth investigating, because I think they're keenly aware of the expense, and so they'll actually charge people with means more and as a way to subsidize others to go, which I think is really kind of beautiful. So I would look into that, but everything I've heard about Goenka retreats is that they're great. So I think you're in good hands. Good luck.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you for being here. I have a question for both of you. Given that you're both seasoned meditators, I'm curious if your thoughts have shifted regarding the value of emotions, specifically negative ones.
Well, they might have shifted, but I think they're shifting back.
Okay.
I briefly imagined that expressing anger may actually be a good thing in certain contexts.
What are you thinking of specifically?
Yes. Among our many things in common, Dan and I both had Ezra Klein on our podcast in the last week, our last few weeks.
I'm clearly the nicer guy because yes. We got along fine.
Yeah. We had very different experiences. But no, I think negative emotion is certainly appropriate and useful in certain contexts. I think it's also useful to get over very, very quickly. I mean, anger can be energizing. You know, outrage, moral outrage can be energizing. Fear can be energizing. But fear is totally appropriate, you know, if you're in a situation of potential physical violence, say, or, you know, if a lion gets out of the cage at the zoo, it's totally appropriate to have the full adrenalized experience of now you're in the presence of some kind of emergency. But how long do you want to suffer the results of that hormonal kind of hijacking of your awareness? And what we tend to do is we keep these emotions alive in our thoughts for much longer than they're useful. And it's just one of these truths you can notice about the nature of the mind, and you really can only notice it by learning to meditate. If you don't get lost in thought about the reason you have to be angry or fearful or anxious or whatever it is, you actually can't maintain that emotion for more than a few seconds at a time. It's impossible to stay angry, no matter what it is. I mean, no matter how grave the injustice that merits anger, it's simply impossible to stay angry for an hour, much less a day. So becoming aware of the mechanics gives you a choice. In the end, you can just you can decide, well, how long do I want to be energized in this way by this stream of thought? And you know, I think most of us, given that ability, will want to get off the ride far earlier than we do. But I wouldn't say that negative emotion is never appropriate or never useful. I think it's classically negative emotions like anger or fear, I think occasionally that we need that energy. It's just you know, what you do with it is something you want to be able to wisely choose.
Yeah, I the more I practice for myself, the more convinced I become of the disutility of things like anger. I agree with Sam that there is a galvanizing quality to it in the face of pretty much everything we talk about on the news. But I don't find that is the most constructive emotion out of which to act. Sam talks about this See, I don't, you probably don't even remember saying this, but I quote you on this all the time, that we experience anger and then we just re-up it through compulsive neurotic thinking. But if you can cut down on that, on what Sam calls the half-life of anger, the amount of damage you can do in an hour of anger versus 2 minutes, I mean, that reduction is just incalculable. And I've just found that for me, cutting down on that has been a huge game changer. It's not to say that I never experienced anger. I spent quite a bit of time in anger today. And I don't think it's the type of thing we should engage in a bunch of self-laceration over because we're experiencing it. But I do think it in my own experience, having now investigated it at length, I don't see much use for it beyond what Sam described in terms of like taking action in extreme situations.
Thank you.
Hey guys, thanks for being here. I'm a big fan of both of you. This question's taking things in a little bit of a different direction, but it's not a perfect analogy, but if you were to look at the human race as somewhat of a hive mind, so we're a collective consciousness, it seems like a lot of the ailments that plague humanity are the same types of ailments that a restless mind experiences. We fluctuate from war to peace to polluting the environment to trying to clean up the environment and then polluting it again to it's just chaos and we don't quite know where we're going as a species. I'm just wondering if you guys think that's a helpful metaphor to view where we're at, and do you think there's some kind of collective meditative state that we could reach, or some kind of way that we could structure society or some of our institutions that take mindfulness and take meditation and those and what that can bring you, the level of awareness that can bring you into account, if that makes any sense.
It doesn't take long spending time in the meditation world before you hear claims about how meditation will fix everything. It will surprise you to hear that I don't believe that. I think, however, that if we see a broad societal embrace of the practice, there will be salutary changes. If we had the same proportion of the population practicing mindfulness that currently engages in physical exercise, I think we'd probably see a real impact on things like road rage, bullying, the type of comments you see on social media, the quality of our politics. I don't think it would make everything, you know, barfing unicorns. But I do think it would start to change things, maybe 10% at a time. see what I did there, Harris? So I do actually think, I'm not a utopian by nature, but I do think that a broad societal embrace of mindfulness could make a difference. How much, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to realize that we have virtually no norm around mental training. Like, mental training is still a totally esoteric concern. And yet physical training is just an absolute norm where it's just impossible to doubt the utility of it, whether you exercise a lot or not. There's nobody who's living in doubt as to whether or not there's something to be done to be physically better off, you know, most of the time. And it seems obvious. I mean, even just thinking of it in physical terms, the brain is an organ which changes depending on how you use it. And we're training ourselves all day long based on how we use our attention to fixate on various things, whether it's social media or, I mean, so much of it now is driven by the phone we've got in our pockets. And you can get better at doing anything you care about. You can get better at having conversations with people. You can get better at in your relationships. Your marriage can get better. The thing you're doing by default is rarely the best possible version of that thing. And when you, and this is so obvious in athletics, because you're learning to play a new sport that you don't know how to play, and you're not in that in shape for that sport, say, and so everything you do is wrong, right? But most of what we are doing with our lives, you kind of sort of go through school, and you get to a point where they say, okay, there's no more school for you on this topic, so you're done. Now get a job, and there's no notion of mental training beyond that. You're just basically who you are, trying to figure out how to live a meaningful life after that. And the traditions out of which practices like meditation come have a very different picture of just of what life, what's possible in terms of being comfortable here in your own skin as a human being, navigating social space with other human beings. And I think if we just acknowledged that emotional and moral development continues throughout life, and even in predictable ways, if you apply your attention in certain ways, or you think, or you just forget about meditation, just reframing situations conceptually can do enormous work in terms of how you feel. It's like road rage is the perfect example. It's a cliche that we've all become, right? We've all experienced this thing where just magically you're in a car and somebody does something in front of you, or is just driving too slow, and a part of your personality emerges that simply does not emerge in other circumstances. When you're not surrounded by glass and metal, this never comes out of you in an elevator with other people, right? Unless you're a total sociopath. But you're in the safety and relative privacy of your car, all of a sudden you're, you know, Uday Hussein. And I mean, mindfulness is useful there, but just a reframing. Like the person who just cuts you off may be on route to some medical emergency, right? So that's like just thinking about what you don't know about that other person's circumstance. The person who's driving slow may be, you know, 90 years old in front of you, right? And how fast do you want that person to drive? So just learning to think new thoughts in those situations is also incredibly useful.
I just want to add to that, because this is, in many ways, the punchline. This is why, you know, you were asking me at the beginning why have I allowed meditation to kind of take over my personal and professional life. To me, the animating insight of this whole jag I'm on is that the mind is trainable. That all the things we want the most, positive social interactions, positive relationships, kindness, compassion, patience, calm, focus, self-awareness, all the things, if we really think about that, we want and need the most. These are not factory settings that can't be tinkered with. These are skills that can be trained. That is huge. It's radical. It's empowering. And that is why we do this, whatever door you enter through.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a word we haven't used as much as we probably should have tonight, which is skill. The skill contains that message that, you know, well-being is a kind of skill in the end.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a good lead into what I was going to ask. I recently did a 10-day retreat, and it was with the Goenka, but I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I recommend it. But I was wondering what my next thing was going to be, and I thought about maybe a 10-day retreat every year, or if they're, I don't know if I have the luxury of doing a, you know, a month retreat, but I also, I had to actually write this down. I don't know if I can pronounce it right, but a huwaska, it's a type of herb, an herb. Yeah. They're having these particular retreats abroad where you can go and I've done hallucinogens when I was a younger person before I got into mindfulness. So I don't know if you know anything about ayahuasca or if you have any recommendations.
Sam's got ayahuasca on an IV drip.
But my ultimate question is, because this was mental development, I think it was the best mental development I ever had. And I think I hadn't really meditated before I'd done my 10-day retreat. So I want to keep developing, and I just kind of wanted to get some recommendations.
Good on you. It's great.
Yeah, do you deal with the psychedelic option in your talking about this?
I've long been interested in exploring things like ayahuasca, psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, LSD, things like that. But my shrink, aided and abetted by my wife, have argued convincingly that for somebody who has panic disorder, as my shrink said, his exact words, fucking with your brain chemistry is not a good idea. So I have not played that game. I mean, I've ingested plenty of drugs in my day, which is what gave me the panic disorder. Also part of the argument. So I have not done that. But I know a lot of really serious people, including the guy to my left, who's
stoned right now?
Yes. Yeah. Just
give me those leftover drugs.
Yes, I'll, exactly.
You take those off your hands.
There have been really interesting studies going on right now at Johns Hopkins of using psilocybin on long-term meditators, and I have friends who are experienced meditation teachers who lead retreats that mix ayahuasca with meditation. And so I'm quite convinced that there's a lot of there, but I'm not, as a public figure, going to strongly recommend it, nor have I done it personally because it might entail either more panic attacks or divorce or both.
I have not done ayahuasca, but I know many people who have. It's very in vogue now, and people are claiming to get a lot of benefit from it, and I certainly don't doubt that. I think that the most significant benefit I got from doing psychedelics back in the day, it's been many years since I've done anything like that, more than a decade since I've done any psychedelic, but what I got from them, which I couldn't have gotten, I don't think I could have gotten otherwise, I was certainly not tending to get it otherwise, is the conviction that it was possible to have a radically different experience than I was tending to have. And it sounds like you already have that conviction because you're already going to sit 10-day retreats. That's not to say psychedelics couldn't be useful for you, and there are certainly people who would argue that there are further benefits than just being convincingly advertised to, that there are other states of consciousness that you'd rather inhabit than the one you're tending to. But the reality is that whatever psychedelic you take, no matter how good the trip, it will wear off, right? I mean, it's impermanent by its very nature. It doesn't give you, it's not quite the same thing as building a skill that you always have recourse to. And there's the other part, which is that it is, the experience you have on any of these drugs is somewhat haphazard, no matter how assiduously you control your set and setting. I mean, you can have the exact same set and the exact same setting and have two very different experiences, one being absolutely sublime and one being harrowingly awful. And it's, in the end, I mean, the reason why I stopped taking psychedelics more or less totally is, for me, there was it felt like a kind of psychological Russian roulette. I mean, it was just like I had no way of expecting what I was going to get, because again, I couldn't control the variables that seemed to matter. So
that's why I spent a lot of time doing cocaine.
Yes, yes.
Dan, earlier you were talking about that.
Am I ruining this event?
No, that's okay. I'm gonna tweet that out as a quote.
Dan, earlier you had mentioned like the bad marketing or the flowery message that meditation had in the past. And like, in my perspective though, there seems to be something more pure and honest about, you know, I guess like the peace, love, the hippie approach to it, you know, the wearing the robes, the long hair like Sam did. You know, not to be cynical, but it seems to be somewhat dishonest or like bullshit when you hear these like CEOs making these ridiculous salaries and they'll talk about like, oh yes, how they meditate and they have guided meditations and stuff like that. So, I mean, is there sort of like a legitimate practitioner versus an illegitimate practitioner? And like, you know, how can we nudge, you know, the people in power towards more, you know, giving up their possessions type direction meditation? So.
Look, you know, it's been a big challenge for the traditional Buddhist community. I consider myself a Buddhist. So it's a big challenge for the traditional Buddhist community to have their beloved practice, you know, spread out to the masses. It, you know, I always joke that we Buddhists have spent so many years assiduously sending, you know, good wishes out to the world, you know, may you be happy, may you be safe. But it turns out there was an asterisk all along, which is if you do it like me. And look, we could take issue with the way some high-profile meditators are choosing to lead their lives, but I'm still of the view that at the end of the day, more mindfulness is better than less mindfulness. So I'm not going to trash talk unless Uday and Kusei take up the practice. I'm not going to get into the business of trash talking or nitpicking every public meditator unless I think they're, you know, doing demonstrable harm in the world. Yes, do I see some of the hypocrisy of the folks that you're referencing? Sure, but I still think it's a better thing for the world that we're seeing meditation seep into areas that are way, 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 way outside the Buddhist ghetto.
My question is about, have either of you ever incorporated sensory deprivation tanks into your practice? And if not, what are your thoughts on that as far as depriving your senses, since most of the practice is to be aware of sounds and sights?
Well, it's been a very long time since I've done it. My friend Joe Rogan is a big believer. Actually,
He bullied me into doing it. We were texting, and I was in LA. I was going to go on his podcast, and he said, why don't you come a couple hours early and get my sensory deprivation tank? And I said, I don't want to do that. And he called me a chicken. And so yeah. I did it.
So how was it? My question would have been, how often do you change the water?
Especially if you're using Joe's water. It's salt water, so it's...
That's supposed to
right,
put me
supposed to be cleaner? I don't know, it's like the Dead Sea. I did find it pretty powerful, yeah. But I don't know, I need
how long? How long were you in?
I was in there, I think he only made me do it for an hour, so...
Well, that's still something.
It's not nothing. Yeah. I did find that it, you know... But I need to do more before I could develop a real opinion about it, but I could get a glimpse of the value.
I think we just got the signal. We're down to our last question, so apologies to those of you in line. This is the way karma works, apparently.
I got good karma today. Various forms of meditation exist, and just curious, are they all created equal, or do you have specific advice on...
Well, they're not. There are different forms which have different purposes. So they're, to kind of use the Buddhist framework here, there are concentration practices where the goal is to focus one pointedly on some object. It could be the breath. It could be a candle flame or an inner visualization. And the goal there is really to focus so one pointedly that you notice nothing else, so that your thoughts really are the antithesis of that practice. If you're thinking, you're not focusing, and you're failing in that moment. And that kind of concentration becomes a tool that can be used for a practice like mindfulness, but it's not the same as a practice like mindfulness. Mindfulness is much more about, you need some concentration, but it's much more about simply noticing what is arising without having any expectation that any thing should or shouldn't arise, and that begins to change the character of your experience, and you begin to have various insights. But a concentration practice is a much more narrowly focused thing, which is a useful skill, but it's just it is the thing that becomes, in the end of the day, it can seem like an artifice. It's more like a drug experience, because when concentration really works, it becomes synonymous with very pleasant states of mind, and you can kind of have this sort of heroin addict-like attachment to the pleasantness of meditation, but then it's transitory. When you're no longer concentrated, you're no longer getting that high. And so the other type of practice is called insight practice, of which mindfulness is the technique. And there, it's not about prolonging any specific state. It's about about actually seeing what is common to all states of consciousness and therefore no longer clinging to, I mean, one of the things that's common is they're impermanent and you're no longer clinging to the highs or pushing away the lows.
So. I'm going to assume, and this may be wrong, but I'm going to assume that undergirding your question is a kind of sense of, you know, what kind of meditation should I be doing? And I guess what I would say to you is, at the beginning, there can be a real sense of like wanting to try everything, which I think is cool. I think you should try a bunch of things and see what speaks to you, what tradition, what flavor of meditation speaks to you the most. But then I would stick with one thing, because if you're jumping around too much for too long, you really can't get a clear, clean signal of like what's working. And I would do it for a little while, like a couple of years, and see, you know, what the benefits are, get grounded in one tradition before you go flitting around too much. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry to bring this to a close, but we have to, and we have a book signing. Dan's book is available here, I believe, I hope. And he'll be signing books. I'll be signing postcards so that I have something to do while he signs his book. But thank you all for coming. It's really an honor to talk to you.